Hi, it's Patrick Cox here, and this is the third and final part in our mini-series on language and gender. All three parts stand alone, but if you want to do the chronological thing, go back a couple of episodes, I'll still be here. In the meantime, hi, Nina.
Hey, Patrick.
I want to introduce you to Jack Kwame. Jack's a writer based in Orlando, identifies as non-binary, and has had, you know, conversations about that.
Okay.
My mother actually was the conversation that it actually was a conversation, and it was a very emotional conversation, because when it came to the concept of being of a binary gender, and my name's Jack, so she's asking me, you know, so are you a boy? And I said no. And she goes, so are you a girl? No. Okay, then what?
Oh, yeah. That sounds like one of those awkward conversations with one's parents. You're explaining the world to them.
Yeah. So I mentioned non-binary. That's actually just only a part of how Jack identifies themselves. Here is the full self-identification.
A queer non-binary femme. And if you want to add like Afro-Latinx, like I am all about that.
Latinx sounds a bit like the non-binary mix or the honorific mix that we did two episodes ago. Go back and listen.
Yeah, that X suffix, it just keeps popping up all over the place.
Right.
And it's popping up to indicate what exactly?
Well, gender neutrality, for sure. So it's not Latino or Latina, right? It's Latinx.
Yeah, but what kind of gender neutrality? I mean, you can deny gender completely. I don't know. Is that what's going on? Or is it just a placeholder for any kind of gender?
Or both.
Or both. And maybe that has an awful lot to do with the letter X. I mean, X potentially can do all of these things. So today on the pod, the extraordinary letter X. How in just a few years, it has seemingly undergone a total transformation in meaning that may speak to how we're changing our attitudes to sex and gender.
The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Were you born around Ottawa, Toronto?
No, I was born in Thunder Bay, which is the northwest of Ontario, 1,600 kilometers from Ottawa.
Oh, my goodness.
Ontario is like 2,200 kilometers wide.
I don't really even understand how big that is. That's just massive. Beyond
it takes me 16 hours just to drive to Thunder Bay, and that's 600 kilometers before the end of Ontario.
This guy who's just blown my mind is Ron Smythe. He used to teach linguistics at the University of Toronto. He's retired now. X meant different things to Ron at different points in his life.
When I was a kid in school, X meant wrong and a check mark meant right. That's the way the teacher would mark your answers. And then when you cross something out, the other word for that is to X something out. So if you write something incorrect on an exam, you can put a line through it or put X's through it. So it was always something bad, something wrong, something to get rid of.
X took another turn for Ron around ninth grade, algebra. Thanks to Descartes, there are several letters that stand in for numbers, A, B, C, X, Y, Z, or Z. But X was the teacher's pet, algebra's favorite variable. And what about Xmas for Christmas? Did you ever use that?
Yeah, at first I thought it was an abbreviation. And then I started hearing from people that that was taking the Christ out of Christmas. You hear people upset about that sometimes. You shouldn't write it that way. But in reality, the X is just the Greek letter chi. And when Christmas was abbreviated, they used the first letter of the Greek word for Christ.
Oh, I had another misinterpretation, which is I thought the X indicated a cross. That was what I assumed the X was when I was young.
Well, I think that's the problem, that people also assume that the X is not the letter chi from Greek. I mean, why would anybody who doesn't speak Greek? And so they imposed their own interpretation on it. You thought it was something positive, but Christians who are upset about it think it means that it's putting an X in place of Christ's name, or wiping it out. It's not historically accurate, but people's interpretations are important.
We've always had this sort of association with X as having significance beyond what it stands for.
Adrian Smith is a film historian at the University of Sussex in the UK, and he's studied the history of movie ratings, which began in the UK. They were called certificates. Yes, there were X films in Britain before there were X films in the US. We export all our best stuff. The X certificate was introduced in 1951, just 6 years after the end of the Second World War. It replaced the H certificate. H stood for horror. But that category was too narrow. Film authorities were worried about kids under 16 watching other types of film, too. Like A Streetcar Named Desire.
You put that howling down there and go to bed.
Joss, I want my clothes out here.
You shut up. You're going to get the law on you.
Estella!
You can't beat on a woman and then call her back.
The X was intended to show that the films were for adults, because children at that point were going to the cinema several times a week, it seems. And apparently exhibitors were worried when the certificate first came in that by deliberately excluding a big portion of their audience, their box office would drop, you know, because previously children could come to any film they wanted, but now all of a sudden you're excluding them. That would mean commercial death. Although they soon began to find that the X on a film actually increased the number of people coming, and X films were doing very well.
Good grief! What is it? What are you saying? Let me through!
So exhibitors, in the end, were quite happy.
Oh, that's interesting.
What have I unleashed?
Ghastly, it's horrible!
Oh, you can say that again.
And that may also be to do with the fact that it was called an X. I mean, I why was it called X in the first place?
Well, that is a question which has no answer. It is strange. I've not been able to find any definitive answer. You know, some suggestions are that it was already associated at that point with danger, you know, like poison bottles, for example. So perhaps there was that idea that it was a warning, because this was a certificate that meant children were to be excluded. So it was kind of warning you that this was unsuitable.
Kan du tänka dig att de jobbar hos Forsbergs nu, va?
Ja, nere i min gamla källare, va? De tar in lådor och väger upp och dammet och smutsigt.
That dialogue, you can hear the danger, the unsuitability.
Du, kommer ihåg när novellen vi läste igår, Den laglösa älskan.
This is a Swedish film, Summer with Monica, released in 1953. Back then in Britain, sex was not the subject of polite conversation. But here was a couple of young, carefree runaways rolling around on the beach together with plenty of flesh on view. It got an X rating, which maybe only encouraged the distributors of other art house movies from mainland Europe.
Abba!
C'è Modugno,
il cantante.
Ho detto Modugno, Modugno.
There's an Italian film called Adua and Her Friends, and it's a neorealist drama about a group of prostitutes who open a restaurant after the law was passed. It was called the Merlin Law, which banned brothels in Italy. So this film is depicting what they do after they can't work in brothels anymore, and they open this restaurant, with the idea being that they secretly run a brothel in the upstairs rooms. But it turns out that they love running the restaurant so much they don't want to be prostitutes anymore. But when the film was distributed here, it was retitled and called Hungry for Love, which is sort of pun on the fact that it's about prostitutes who run a restaurant. And the posters for the film were very much based around the imagery of women undressing. Even though in the film itself, there's barely any of that at all. There's got the opening scene in the brothel, but then the rest of it is fully dressed women working in kitchens and serving plates of pasta.
E avete pure un bel locale. E poi si mangia anche bene.
Grazie, signor Modugno. La prossima volta speriamo di fare anche meglio.
Where the art house directors were kind of flourishing, you also had more exploitative directors coming in and making films purely to make money and to get an X certificate. And I'm sure it's no coincidence that by the late 1950s, there was a whole rash of films set in or shot in nudist camps. So you began to get stories filmed in real nudist camps purely because of the opportunities that this new adult audience were presenting.
And now, Mr. Sutton, I'd be grateful if you'd show me around the camp.
Of course.
Well, Mr. Sutton?
Yes?
Do I have to take my clothes off?
So that's what you've been watching on your laptop at work, Patrick.
yeah. My browsing history requires a little bit of explanation.
Interesting. So these are just films of nudist camps? Like, is there sex involved, or is it just kind of a day in the life of a nudist colony?
Yeah, the women are topless. The bottoms are kind of awfully covered up, you know, by sort of like objects that are in the way and things like this. They were set in nudist camps. I'm assuming that some of the actors were people who went to the nudist camps were nudists.
That's very odd. So that seems still a little bit PG when I think about X-rated films.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the mid-60s.
All fun and games.
All fun and games. Things were just about to change incredibly rapidly. And some of it was kind of self-imposed from the film authorities. So the UK switched the age for X movies that you could go and see from 16 to the age of 18, which immediately sort of indicated to the movie makers that, you know, they could make much raunchier movies now because only adults would be watching.
Right.
And just around the same time, in the U.S., the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, they introduced ratings for the very first time. And this replaced the so-called production code, which were kind of moral guidelines that sometimes were strictly enforced and other times weren't enforced at all. And among the ratings was, for the very first time in North America, the letter X.
Oh.
So for Ron Smythe, who associated X with getting the wrong answer at school and with Xmas, Christmas. Here it was again for him in the late 1960s.
I was a teenager at the time, and with Playboy magazine, with Hugh Hefner, there was always a lot of discussion about obscenity and swear words and so on. And both he and the founder of Hustler magazine, Larry Flint, did a lot of work on trying to liberalize society and get rid of obscenity laws, allow people to published texts that included swear words, nude pictures, and eventually full-blown pornographic films.
And anyone who would ask me to lay these principles aside, I say to them, in the language that I know best, two words, shove it.
And shove it they did. They being mainstream, sometimes Puritan, America. Larry Flint successfully used the First Amendment to get his pornography published. All of which means I'm not going to play any more movie clips. X-rated just became X-rated. The funny thing about the rating system in the US was that unlike the PG rating or the R rating, X was never copyrighted by the MPAA.
Because what they thought was that filmmakers could self-impose the X if they thought their film would receive an X rating. But very quickly, because anybody could call their film an X, because of the First Amendment, film was kind of protected and anybody could do pretty much anything. So you began to get hardcore pornography, which was never submitted to the MPAA, but they could put on their posters that they had an X.
Just like in Britain a couple of decades before, X became a badge of sleazy honor. You'd have thought that the Americans might have learned from the British experience. Like, which letter in the alphabet is included in excitement, explicit, sex? Hey, we're humans. We don't learn from history. Pretty soon, there was total segregation based on ratings. X movie became a synonym for pornography. And these movies got their own theaters, even their own theater districts.
Like 42nd Street in New York, you know, the whole sort of grindhouse thing. And you couldn't get an X in a normal cinema because the cinema owners were afraid that if they showed X films, families would stop coming to their cinemas because they would think it was pornography. So it was a big problem. And that lasted for about 20 years until 1990. Eventually, the MPAA stopped issuing X entirely and replaced it with what you now have, which is the NC-17.
And so X was on the road to rehab.
For the first time ever, Xers are out in the world.
Oh, yes, Generation X.
And because Xers are holding the mics, we get to shape the message.
Even if the message, kind of like the name Generation X, lacked definition. After Gen X, though, the floodgates opened. X again became more than just porn, and it took no time at all for us all to fall back in love with it.
And for brands to love it, Patrick. iPhone X, even though it's iPhone 10, it's the iPhone X. SpaceX.
I came across a funny one the other day. HBX, Harvard Business School's online classes.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah. It's like the X makes it sound shiny and futuristic.
So what about the latest turn, the X indicating gender neutrality, like Latinx?
Okay, well, let's go back to Jack Kwame, the Afro-Latinx writer.
So in Spanish, a lot of words are masculinized and feminized. Latino is supposed to be a masculinized term. It would imply a man or masculine person who is of Latin descent. In Spanish, the masculinized version of words is considered gender neutral. But that obviously doesn't work for some of us because I don't think it's appropriate to assign masculinity as gender neutral when it isn't, no matter how lightly that is implied. So the X, in a lot of ways, is a way of rejecting the gendering of words to begin with, especially since Spanish is such a gendered language.
So Latinx is not corporate speak like those other, you know, iPhone X and stuff.
Yeah.
But it does have that futuristic feel in common with those other X words. But the main point of it, the way that Jack sees it, is that it rejects gender. It denies gender.
And that's interesting when you're denying gender in a very gendered language.
Right. I mean,
every noun is gender.
And the only way you can get around that is by inventing stuff, like stuff that breaks the rules. And once you do that, you really start pissing people off.
So if you haven't noticed already, you've been seeing this term called Latinx showing up, or Latinx. It sounds like Kleenex. And honestly, as a Latino myself, I cringe every time I see it. I think it's ridiculous. But I
yeah, there's a lot of this that you can find on YouTube if you search Latinx. And in some Spanish-speaking countries, Latinx, it isn't the default for a gender-neutral version of Latino / Latina, as linguist Ron Smythe has noticed.
I speak Spanish, and I live in Buenos Aires about 6 months a year. And there, in order to not specify someone's sex or gender, they tend to use the asterisk. And so there's a film festival called Asterisco, because it's an LGBTQ film festival, and this is a current topic in LGBTQ circles. People prefer often not to specify their sex or gender.
So no Latinx?
Apparently not. And there are other ways of expressing this gender neutrality, too. Mm. So you can use a dash. So it would be like L-A-T-I-N dash.
Oh, interesting.
Or the at sign, which actually works really well as a graphic because it looks like an A with an O around it.
Yeah, but there is an obvious problem with that.
Yeah.
None of these solutions works very well, really, because they're mainly unpronounceable. Latinx, L-A-T-I-N-X, is pronounceable. But that's English, because the word X in Spanish is X. So if you were trying to say that or write it that way in Spanish, why wouldn't it be pronounced Latinx?
Right.
So in a way, this Latinx is based on English pronunciation and the English name of the letter X. It's not exactly native to Spanish.
Yeah, and that may account for just how popular Latinx is here in the U.S., specifically among bilingual people when they're speaking English. Like, it's fine to butcher another language like Spanish if you're speaking English.
Right.
It's not so good to butcher it if you're speaking that language itself. So it seems to be much more of an English word.
That's really, really interesting. How are people pluralizing Latinx?
That is a huge problem. It's more of a problem in Spanish, but even in English, like Latinxes? Have you ever heard anyone say that?
No. I've only heard it being used singularly. That's interesting.
Even so, there does seem to be evidence that Latinx in English is showing signs of really taking hold. So those other unpronounceable terms, like the one with the at sign and the asterisk and stuff, they only really exist among small groups of people, activists or on campus.
Uh-huh.
But Latinx, it looks like it's making the jump to the mainstream. Not that a lot of people aren't adamantly opposed to it. They are. But there are people who are using it to do things like buy and sell stuff. Like, I found people exchanging beauty tips who self-identify as Latinx beauty bloggers, that kind of thing. There's also a business online called Shop Latinx.
Oh, interesting. Getting back to the question that we posed at the beginning, is there an understanding of what it is actually indicating? Like, all the genders or fluidity of genders, like, what does Latinx actually mean?
Right. I mean, remember Jack Quemmie's definition?
Right.
The X is a way of rejecting gender.
Yeah.
So Ron Smythe, he doesn't think that's the only way of describing what the X is doing.
I think if you drill down into it, there are two main explanations. One of them is to be completely gender neutral by no longer having any gender whatsoever in the word. That would be the effacing, the crossing out, the removing gender interpretation. But by the same token, exactly the same situation could involve using the variable X. So when you use the X to replace O or A, what you're saying is it covers both masculine and feminine. So the gender is still there. It's just the two are collapsed into one form, the X. So I don't know, any individual person who talks about the X being gender neutral, one person might say that's because we're removing gender. We don't even want to have any thought about it, psychologically speaking. Another person could say, no, that means masculine and feminine. So the gender is present for that person. And I don't know if speakers in general have come to a consensus about what the X really does, whether it effaces or acts as a variable.
I would add to that that I think that there's a kind of a radical quality to the X, or almost transgressive. And I think that links back to how it's previously been used, you know, whether it's the poison bottle or X-rated movies, or for that matter, you know, someone like Malcolm X. That was a radical renaming that he did. He was born Malcolm Little.
So what you're saying, Patrick, essentially is X definitely doesn't mark the spot. X means something much more fluid.
Yeah, it seems to be the very nature of the letter X, like going right back to Descartes and this idea that it stands for something, and that something changes according to the context.
And it seems like according to the generation, it seems like this has evolved as generations have evolved, and who knows what it's going to evolve to next.
And the other big question is, how much are all of these innovations actually going to take hold? So Jack Quemmie talked right at the very top of the pod about having that conversation with their mom about who they are. And it was a difficult conversation.
Right.
There were a lot of questions. And I must say, I just thought there wasn't maybe a lot of acceptance on the part of their mom. But actually, as it turns out, there's a little bit of acceptance from their mom.
She's of a different generation, obviously, but also, you know, she's from a small island, and Spanish is, especially the way that we speak it in Puerto Rico, it's not so grammatically correct. It's more slang. She speaks English and Spanish. Both my parents do. But I don't think the concept of gender-neutral language really made sense to her. Although I do see, she sends me birthday cards and things and little notes in the mail, and she is, you know, very specifically trying to not just, you know, use gender-neutral language, but also refer to me in things that could be used for any gender. You know, my little one. It's very sweet.
So the great thing about X is it has endless meanings, Patrick.
That's for sure.
I mean, we're going to talk about the kissing XX.
Okay, so here's this thing, right? In the UK, we do X's, like in a letter or the end of an email or something like that.
Like XXOO?
No O's.
No just, O's?
Just
what
X's.
What happened to the hugs?
We never had them in the first place. We hug, but we just don't write it down. So we write X's.
Like XXX?
Yes.
Or and just two X's. Would you go XXX?
Well, it depends how friendly you are with the person. But you're not indicating anything like sexual or anything like that. It's just friendly.
Huh.
And I get caught out all the time with American friends who are not used to this, so I'll put an XX. And it just is considered in some way just too forward or whatever. And in the UK, it's not. XXXO. You want me? But this song, XXXO, I just wouldn't put the O there, just the XXX.
Wow, I can't imagine someone signing off with XXX to me on an email. But yeah, this is a good song.
XXXO by MIA. Thanks today to Lal Zimmern and Paulus Van Horn for research help and production.
Also thanks to Tina Toby, who mixed this episode, Mike Wilkins, Leo Hornack, Jonathan Dyer, Jody Gersh, Lauren Rothering, Andrew Sussman, and Carol Zoll.
Also, Anna Pratt and Andrea Crossan and the AWL Project, that's Across Women's Lives. There's a bunch of stories there related to our series. They're at pri.org/, what is it?
Across Women's Lives.
The whole thing.
Yes.
Across
Spell it all
Women's
out.
Lives. And finally, a really big thank you to Ron Smythe for not just talking to us about X, but his advice on the whole series.
And if you want to see the nudist colony video that Patrick's been
I'm not going to post
every
that.
Every day on his laptop.
Stop it.
There are all kinds of photos and videos on the series at pri.org/language. That's our site.
Don't forget to leave us a review wherever you listen to The World in Words. Thanks, and we'll be back soon.
XXO.
The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
There was a joke made at my day job the other day about how I should be a teacher. And there's somebody I work with who also speaks Spanish and was like referring to me. Since I'm very femme and feminine presenting, I often get feminine pronouns thrown at me or feminine titles thrown at me. So she said, oh, maestra. Maestra is teacher in Spanish, but female teacher. And I said, no, maestrex.